Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're about to have a conversation with Dr. Aviva Chomsky, who's a professor of history and the coordinator of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Her latest book is Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal. And Aviva Chomsky, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the program.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we talk about the book, which I and the fascinating way you look at immigration, the whole notion of what illegality means, I know you as a Latin American expert. I have to ask somebody this question today, so you're it.
Okay, here I am.
And you've written books about Colombia before.
Yes, I actually do a lot of work on Colombia.
And so we saw this the president of Colombia make this groundbreaking agreement with FARC, the guerrillas in Colombia, ending a war that killed over 220,000 people, many by this state terror itself, not just FARC. And the majority of voters, by the smallest of margins, just like maybe 40,000 people, voted to turn down the agreement. What's the politics here? What happened?
Okay, a lot of different things are going on, so I'll just mention some of them. One is that another piece of it is not just who voted yes and who voted no, but who abstained, because the majority of registered voters abstained. There was a very low turnout, well under 50%.
That's interesting.
So we also need to ask not just why did so many people vote no, but why did so many people choose not to vote? And I think probably our answer to why did so many people vote no is clearer than is our answer to why did so many people choose not to vote. Why did so many people vote no? Well, let's look at who voted no, first of all. In the areas most affected by the war, at the areas that have been most victimized by the FARC, people overwhelmingly voted yes. Those people want peace. The people who voted no tended to come from the areas that are dominated by Colombia's old elite. And when I say the old elite, I mean the most historic conservative recalcitrant land-based ranching elite. And that is the main source of support for former President Uribe, who campaigned very strongly against the referendum. President Santos, the current president who negotiated the accords, represents more Colombia's new, modernizing, globalized elite. That new, modernizing, globalized elite wants peace. And we see that the yes also won in places like Bogota. It's in some of the cities where the old paramilitary-connected landholding elites dominate, like Medellin, where the no vote was the strongest. And I say that President Uribe, who represents that old elite, campaigned very strongly against the accord. So what was his argument? His argument, and the whole no argument, was that the accord gives too much to the FARC, that we need a military solution to destroy the FARC. The people who've been most victimized by the FARC know that that's not going to happen and that continuing the war means that they're going to continue to be victimized. They're the ones who want peace.
And FARC itself is a complex group.
Yes, very complex, with a very long and complex history.
So maybe I'd love to have the discussion sometime soon. Maybe we'll invite you back just to focus on that. I really would love to kind of really get into that in a deep way, because there's so much confusion around that issue. Even among progressive thinkers here in America, there's a lot of differences of opinion about FARC and about this deal that was made. So I'd be very curious to hear that conversation take place. But let's talk about your book.
Okay. I'd be happy to talk about Colombia the whole time.
Right, yeah. I sure would I, but it's good for people to get a sense of what your book is here.
And this is another controversial and very timely topic. So
it is, because we look at immigration as being one of the central arguments taking place in this presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge debate taking place in America. And the overarching concept here about the idea that illegal immigration is not something that is really has been part of America for a very long time. There's only been a function in the last 50 years that we think of illegal immigration and what that really means.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Talk a bit about that.
So obviously immigration is a very long-standing phenomenon in the country, and Mexican immigration in particular is a very long-standing phenomenon in the country. But making Mexican immigration illegal is something rather new, and this emphasis on the idea of illegality and that Mexican migrants are thrown into this category of illegality, that, I argue in the book, is really a post-1965 phenomenon. So why did this happen in 1965, that Mexican immigration was made illegal? Well, I argue that before 1965, Mexican immigration was always deportable. And it was deportable on the basis of this sort of vague association of nationality and race that went into the making of U.S. immigration law and the making of U.S. popular culture, that Mexicans were always defined as deportable, both legally and popularly. And that this system of deportable Mexican labor worked very well for the employers of Mexican labor because they could bring them into work and then kick them out without giving them decent pay, without giving them the rights that American workers have, without having to deal with unemployment insurance, without having to deal with paying taxes that would educate their children. So deportable Mexican labor worked really well under numerous different legal guises until the 1960s. In the 1960s, in the context of civil rights mobilization by Mexican Americans, among many other groups, this long-standing notion of importing deportable Mexican labor started to lose legitimacy. And the system, the legal systems of deportability started to be taken apart. And this happens with the new immigration law of 1965, with the ending of the Bracero program in 1964. But in order to continue the system of deportable Mexican labor under a new name, Mexican workers were made illegal, and illegality was made a pretext, a reason for deportation. So even though there were some really dramatic legal changes in the 1960s, some of which are what created this illegality, those changes both reduced the racist notion of making Mexican labor deportable and reproduced the racist notion of making Mexican labor deportable under this new pretext of illegality.
So there's so much here that, well, let me just stop for one moment. And you use the term bracero, and describing a system of bringing workers into this country that went back to Mexico and farmed the fields, mostly across the country, and be able to open. It was actually an open border more than anything else in that sense. People going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But talk a bit about that and the relationship to the role that Mexican workers played in this country. Why it was clamped down on, and what the Bracero program really was.
So when we talk about the Bracero program, we're generally talking about the program with that name that existed between 1942 and 1964. It was one of many different systems implemented since the mid-19th century for, as I was saying, deportable Mexican labor. So the Bracero program was a World War II program agreed upon, elaborated by the U.S. and Mexican governments for U.S. companies to basically recruit workers in Mexico, have their transport, et cetera, funded by the U.S. government to bring them into the United States to fill labor shortages created by the war. This wasn't the first time. That is, it's part of a long continuing process of importation and deportation of Mexican labor. These were temporary labor contracts. What this does is sort of formalize a system that's been going on informally ever since the mid-19th century of U.S. employers recruiting workers in Mexico. Why do U.S. employers need Mexican workers so much? The entire building industrialization, building of railroads, creation of a mining economy, creation of an agricultural economy in the western southwestern and western portion of the United States was done by Mexican workers. So the Bracero program created these temporary work contracts that were overseen by the U.S. government so that when the job was done, when the harvest season was over, and the Bracero program was especially funneled Mexican workers into agriculture for temporary seasonal labor, unlike the railroad and mining labor that needed longer-term workers,
mm-hmm.
They would be deported at the end of the contract. And they were completely under the control of the employer and the government the whole time they were there. So if they were to leave their job or protest their work, they could just be deported immediately. So it was really a system of labor control that worked very well for the employers to get access to cheap, controllable labor. That formalized the system and sort of put it under the control of the U.S. government, that the U.S. government was going to help employers bring in this deportable labor to fulfill their short-term labor needs. There was a lot of protest against this as farm workers started organizing in the 1950s and 1960s, and this human rights, labor rights, civil rights protest is part of what led to the Bracero program eventually being abolished in 1964. But as I was saying earlier, even though the formal program is abolished, the basic system remains, just now it's sort of pushed underground.
So I want to get into the question of illegality here in a deeper way, but I'm going to take us just for a moment back to the 19th century. Because you also write about these two pieces, I think they're really important, that after the War of 1848 with Mexico and America, as you put it, sold over 50% of Mexican territory and created the Southwest United States, there was always this kind of round-robin people moving back and forth between Mexico and the United States with little issue, which you can talk about. But then also came the kind of twist that we never think about when it comes to this kind of immigration with the 14th Amendment. That mm-hmm. happened post-Civil War in 1865 when it was ratified in 1868. And we never really think about that as being a factor in what we're dealing with today.
So, on one hand, we have people like President Obama and Hillary Clinton saying, we're a country that has always welcomed immigrants. That's who we are. We welcome immigrants. We're a country of immigrants. And that is both true and a little more complicated than what they're suggesting, because what I argue in the book is that we are a country that always welcomed immigrants until the 14th Amendment was passed. We are a country that was built on immigrants until the 14th Amendment was passed. That is, we're basically a white settler colonial country. We're a country that from its colonial days and from the very beginning of founding an independent country, welcomed immigrants because immigrants were legally defined as white people. And immigrants were welcomed because it was a project of population replacement that is increasing the white population so as to create a white settler colony. Not everybody in the United States was white, but only white people could be citizens. Citizenship was based on race. So to say we're a country of immigrants at that time was almost the same as saying we are a white country, because anybody who came to this area who wasn't white was not an immigrant because they couldn't be a citizen. Anybody who was already in this area who wasn't white could not be a citizen. I'm speaking particularly of Native Americans and African Americans here. Citizenship was restricted to white people. So if we look back at that period and say we're a country of immigrants, we're basically saying we're a white settler society that tried to racially whiten the population through immigration. It's true, but it's not a very pretty history of saying we're a country of immigrants. Now, after 1868, this changes because the 14th Amendment creates this new concept of citizenship by birth, that anybody born in the territory, regardless of race, can be a citizen, is automatically a citizen. So citizenship
except for Native people.
Except for Native Americans,
right,
yes.
Right,
the 14th
right,
Amendment
right.
very, very clearly excludes Native Americans from this. It's aimed at African Americans. It's aimed at rectifying the wrongs caused by enslavement, transportation, and the slave society, the enslavement of African Americans, of Africans and African Americans. So citizenship by birth has serious effects on immigration law, because Congress suddenly is confronted with, oh, but if we let people immigrate, now they're even if they are racially excluded from citizenship, their children are going to automatically be citizens by birth. So as soon as citizenship by birth is created, that's when we start seeing restrictions on immigration. And these restrictions come in a flood. Oh, we can't let these people come in. We can't let those people come in. We can't let these people come in. We can't let those people come in, because they would be able to take advantage of citizenship by birth and threaten white dominance in the country. So between 1868 and 1965, we can't really say that we're a country that welcomed immigrants. Once again, what we can say is that we're a country that welcomed white immigrants, because non-white immigration was legally restricted during that period. But, and this is a big but, while immigration from China, from Japan, from India, from the Middle East, from Africa was being restricted during this post-1868 period, migration from Mexico was not restricted, because Mexicans were necessary for labor and they were deportable.
Right.
So this is where, like, the racialization of deportability comes in. Mexicans continued to be welcomed. In fact, as other immigrants were restricted, Mexicans were sought even more eagerly by employers in the Southwest, but always under the condition that they were deportable. So the idea was, oh, well, that we don't have to worry about the racial impact of Mexican migration, because we'll deport them before they give birth. And this is what we see really formalized in the Bracero program, both the first Bracero program during World War I and the second that I was talking about earlier during World War II, is that only single men will be brought into the country, and we'll send them back to Mexico before they can start impregnating anyone. So this combination of natalist policies, that is, policies aimed at preventing Mexicans from giving birth in the United States and taking advantage of citizenship by birth, racism, and the defining of Mexicans as deportable workers, those are all tied up in the pre-1965 period.
So this opens a question I think is really important for us to explore. So as you write in your book, and I've said in the show numerous times, that immigration, European immigration in the early part of the 20th century, 25 million people, as you write, only 1 million people were sent back. It was not a question of people had to get visas and come to America. They came to America, to Ellis Island, to the Port of Baltimore, to many other places, and were routinely let in, even though many people in the white upper elite didn't like Italians or Jews or Poles or people who they thought as inferior to them. But they were allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this new way of looking at the notion of illegal. So illegal is really a modern new phenomenon. So if we can connect that dot for us, why that's happening, how that takes place today. But then what is it we have to begin to wrestle with to really change the mindset of America and the mindset of our elite about the notion of illegal immigration, given the history of who we are and that never existed before this moment?
Okay. That's a lot of questions in one.
How
long do I have to answer?
About 30 seconds. I'm just kidding. But just kind of, you know, I'm sorry to throw that all at you the last second.
Yeah, no. That's good. So let me just also mention, because I think a lot of people are aware of this and are going to ask, well, where does this fit in? Which is that those Europeans who you mentioned, the Italians, the Poles, their immigration was also restricted after 1921.
Right.
That is, there was a period when the United States went so far as to even restrict European immigration, and precisely of those Europeans who were considered not quite white enough, like just a little bit racially suspect. They're white, but they're not really Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So I did want to bring that into the picture, too, that their immigration was also restricted. But, you know, you say the mindset of elites, and I think we have to complicate that idea, because really I think that elites of the United States benefit from the current system of illegality. If we think of the elites as the employing and investing classes, they benefit from not just from immigration, but in particular from illegality. That is, they benefit from exploitation, legal discrimination against certain groups of people, because that allows them to make more profits. So we do have to change their mindset, but we have to change their mindset to make them value democracy, human rights more than profits. I think popular sentiment against immigration comes from a different mindset. It's not a mindset of wanting more exploitation in order to make more profits, which I think is the mindset of the elites. I think popular sentiment against immigration comes from anxiety. It comes from anxiety by seeing exactly what this situation of undocumentedness plays into an economy that is working against not just undocumented immigrants, but a good portion of the citizen population of the United States. So it's not undocumented immigrants themselves that are the threat to unemployed or poorly employed Americans. It's the economic system. And I think that's where we need to change the popular mindset, is to help people understand how the system works and how elites may be trying to pit undocumented immigrants against American citizens and say, well, there aren't enough jobs for everybody, and so we're going to give it to the lowest paid workers, but to understand how this neoliberal capitalism is working against the interests of both citizen American workers and undocumented immigrants.
I mean, I think that, you know, this really deserves a much larger conversation, which I hope we can do one day soon. The book is wonderful. Your book about breaking the myths of taking our jobs is incredible. You've done some great work over the years, and I've been an admirer of your work for a long time.
Well, thank you.
So I do appreciate you taking the time with us here today, and thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to meeting you.
Yes, I look forward to meeting you, too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Take care.
You too.
We'll be right back when we talk with Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch about bail reform. Stay with us.